This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, open year-round. Learn more at bbg.org. I'm HRN's Communications Director, Kat Johnson, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. We're fresh off our trip to Slow Food Nations in Denver, a festival that brought together advocates to discuss the future of food. And this week, we're bringing you a special episode inspired by the new Equity, Inclusion, and Justice Manifesto released by Slow Food USA.
If we're going to solve food security, we need to say these people have a right to good, healthful food. But we have to do that in a way that kind of insulates this system from the vagaries of the market.
Because when you're at a table with somebody, you recognize their humanity. And when somebody cooks for you and serves you food, in a way they're saying they care about your survival.
How can we put things into our own hands and have the people of Puerto Rico gain real access to healthy local foods?
Listen to Meat and Three this week for our highlights from Slow Food Nations, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
I know in the beginning I tried to, especially with all the pressure on me, that I wanted to know everything and I wanted to teach people. And then I think one day I came to the understanding that I don't. And I don't want to be that person who just fakes it till they make it. Like, I want to be open about, if I don't know how to do something,
yeah,
I want to learn.
That is Chef Emma Benson of Aquavit Restaurant in New York City, our guest this week on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, here with...
Caitlin Friedman.
Good morning, Caitlin.
Hi, Andrew.
This is a special morning edition. This is a beat the train edition.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to be highly efficient.
We're going to be... People may think the speed on their playback is turned up because we need to get you to the commuter train. Because we had a great dinner last night at Battersby Restaurant in Brooklyn.
Oh, my God. It was so good.
Walker Stern, the chef there, we just let it rip. We said, go for it. Have your way with us.
But, you know, he made a pasta with truffle and tomato, and I don't think I've ever had that combo before.
Mm-hmm. Summer truffle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really good.
Really good. Yeah. Everything was great. Can I just say that I'm having a bit of an identity crisis, and I don't even know what to say next right now?
This sounds a little familiar, though.
Yeah, I know it sounds familiar. You're still pissed?
I don't know. I felt, you know, so what, you can tell people what happened.
So last week,
yeah,
I did a whole show intro. It was the Phil Rosenthal episode. Phil was our first non-chef guest. We called it an open kitchen episode. You and I recorded an intro.
Yeah, which we thought was good. We had fun.
We had fun.
Yeah.
I felt like when I played it back, I sounded almost apologetic for having Phil Rosenthal, who's a pretty big guest to have on the show, because I went into all these contortions defending the decision to have a non-chef guest, right?
Mm-hmm.
So after you went off to work, I re-recorded the intro by myself, and you were displeased.
Well, for a couple reasons, but I will just quickly say it was probably the best intro we've ever done.
That's not
ever.
True. Stop.
It was so, we talked about it for hours. It was so, you guys really missed
that. Like, is like
the best intro.
That is far from a true
we were
statement.
Funny, you've just hurt on
your,
point.
This is intellectually dishonest. You've just hurt your case. I have no more, I don't feel bad anymore.
All right, let's keep going.
I don't feel bad anymore.
I have a train to catch. Let's keep going.
So, but no, I am having a little bit of an identity crisis because I'm always soliciting feedback from people, and I got a very sweet review, or got a very sweet review on iTunes, 5-star review, but the person who wrote it said the only complaint was that the intros are too long, and it said something like less of Andrew and family and more just chefs, right? And I want to be clear when I'm saying this, I appreciated that feedback. I didn't mind that it was done publicly. I am always looking for feedback. I want to know. It's very hard sitting here in our house in Hastings on Hudson.
To say that. This guy's going to get annoyed.
What?
This house in Hudson. You're talking home and family.
Oh. No, but I'm saying it's hard from here to have a sense of how this plays, right? So I actually put the comment on Instagram and said, hey, this is really valuable feedback. I'd love to hear from people. Blah, 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 blah. You know, here's the way you can reach me through a comment or a direct message and whatever. I think I even gave my email address. And then all the comments that people wrote said, no, 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 we like the intros. Like everyone said, oh, I like the intros there. I like them. I like hearing from you guys. I disagree. So A, I felt terrible because I feel like it looked like I set this person up who I still appreciate their comment. And B, now I'm just confused because clearly there are listeners who feel like these intros are too long. I'm in the middle of the sentence. I'm actually having a, like, should I finish the sentence?
I think that's a good idea. You can just finish the sentence, put a button on it, do the intro.
Do you think the intros are too long?
Sometimes we ramble. That's fine. I mean, sometimes I go, oh, like right now I'm going, we're still talking about this, and I have to catch a train. So I want us to talk about.
Yeah, but this was, what was that show that it was about? Seinfeld. That was successful.
All right, come on, keep going. I think that there's a nice middle ground.
Hmm.
Or this guy just really wants you to jump into the interviews with the chefs, in which case he should skip ahead.
I think middle ground is the right way. Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking maybe I could write longer show descriptions every week. And put, I think Film Spotting does this and put time cues. Like intro 0 to 8.
Maybe. But this is just, this is part of the experience of the show.
Part of the experience of the show.
Yeah.
Okay. This week's guest is Chef Emma Benson. Emma, have you met her?
I have not.
Well, you need to meet her. Emma is, I barely know Emma Benson. Emma is the chef of Aquavit Restaurant in New York. You and I have a long history with Aquavit.
I've been to Aquavit many times.
Because a million years ago when it was in its original home, Marcus Samuelson was the chef. That was several chefs ago. And I was his publicist there. And then I represented that restaurant in the 90s. And Emma has this amazing story. She comes from Sweden. She is, I don't want to embarrass her, but she is very open about the fact that she's a bit shy for interviews. But this was the third time I've interviewed her, the second time I've interviewed her for a podcast. And she's really smart. She's kind of subtly very funny. She's very thought out in her ideas. And she has this incredible story. And the story is she was the pastry chef at Aquavit. The way she became a pastry chef to begin with is something I won't spoil, but it's this very kind of funny moment that says a lot about kitchens that's in the interview. And after the prior chef left the restaurant, are you actually yawning?
No, I didn't yawn.
After I talked about my identity crisis?
I did not yawn.
Oh, my God.
Keep going.
Come on. What kind of wife are you?
It just happened. It wasn't at nothing.
I want like Adrian from Rocky.
It had nothing to do.
Like, do me a favor. Win.
It had nothing to do with what you were saying. So go ahead.
Emma, after the prior chef left the restaurant, Emma became the chef. She transitioned from pastry to being the overall chef of the restaurant. This rarely happens. I don't know of another instance where it did. And she's just knocked it out of the park. She's got 2 Michelin stars there. The food's incredible. I've had it. It's also quite beautiful. So I have wanted to sit down with her for this show. I do feel a little hesitant to ask Emma for interviews because I know that she has a little bit of stage fright. Well, I don't even know if stage fright is too strong.
Is she just shy?
I think she's a little shy. I think there. Will you relate to this?
Yeah, I'm shy.
But much like, it was interesting because I was talking with her, and you know, it reminds me a little bit of our daughter. Mm. You know, because our daughter is a little bit shy, but is fearless. Like, she will do anything. She flew alone when she was 9 years old. You know. And Emma reminds me a little bit of that. Like, Emma seems also fearless to me, just doesn't particularly relish speaking publicly, you know? So given all that, I feel like we had a really great conversation. I think she's got a great story. We met in the morning last week at Aquavit. We sat at the bar and set up the mics, and that was it. What do you think? Should I get right to it?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm curious.
So with that, imagine yourself walking through the very loud concrete canyons of Midtown Manhattan on a summer morning, walking into Aquavit, walking past the host area to the bar where you see me and Emma beginning our interview. Here you go. Good morning.
Good morning.
When I walked in here this morning, you told me that we had been interviewed for the same special report on another podcast. My recollection is when I first met you and first arranged to interview you, it seemed to me like you were a little shy about publicity. You're smiling as I say this. This seems to me like something that's changed a little for you. When I first wanted to interview you years ago, your publicist said, well, she doesn't do that many interviews, you know, which is a funny thing for a publicist to say. But it seems like you've kind of, I don't know, it seems like you've kind of settled into this part of the job, if that's what we look at it as.
I'm definitely getting more comfortable with it.
Yeah.
And it's getting easier and easier for every time I do it. So
yeah.
I'm not that nervous anymore. And I practiced a lot with the speaking. Yeah, I try.
What do you mean practice?
I try and have conversations at home or with my sister and things like that, just to get the conversation going a little bit more than just interrupting myself.
Oh, really? So, oh, that's interesting.
I do a little bit of practicing.
Okay, and you think of that as practice for this kind of thing?
Yes, because I know a lot of times when I did interviews in the beginning, it was a lot of empty space and
short
thinking
answers.
And short answers.
Right,
and
yes, and no
like
yes or no answers.
Yes.
It doesn't make for great radio.
No.
Can we go all the way back?
Sure.
Can we talk about how you... Well, I mean, I don't need all the private details of your family, but about cooking. If I ask you how you started to think about maybe doing what you do now, right? If you look all the way back to when you were a kid, whether or not you knew it at the time, right? Whether it was cooking, restaurants, food in general, cookbooks, what first sort of, when you look back at it now, what do you think was the first sort of spark for you?
I think it was when I started actually cooking desserts and pastries and things like that.
At home?
At home, yeah. We had this big backyard with everything from rhubarbs to apples, blueberries, anything you can think of, really. And I started making pies and chocolate cakes and things like that.
So you did this with a family member?
No, just me.
Just you?
Yeah.
So what was your source of instruction? Was it books?
My grandmother, her recipes.
Her recipes.
Yeah, she's the one who handed them down to me.
They were written?
Yes.
Index cards?
Yes.
Within a little
box?
Card.
No, they weren't in a box, but I got little papers that she would rip off her notebook. So
oh, really?
I still have them today. It's
really?
It's really cute.
Oh, that's great. About how many? How thick of a stack is this?
It's not that big of a stack.
Okay.
But
it kept you busy as a child.
It kept me busy as a child, yeah.
Did you have, when you started to do that, and you were just, I assume, you probably enjoyed the final product, and B, you started, obviously, to enjoy the process. Did you have a natural aptitude? Did you find, in other words, like if you were making pastry dough, did your fingers sort of know what to do? Did you have good hands, as they say, or soft hands? Did you tend to pick things up quickly, or was it work for you?
I think the reason why I love doing it that much is because it was one of the few things in life that didn't require very much work from me.
It came naturally.
It came naturally, and everything else with school and study and sitting still and all of those things that you were supposed to do, it was a real struggle for me. So
they were.
This was it was one of those things I feel I do and not think that much about it.
Can you talk to me about the school piece? Because it's funny. Some people have pushed back on me and told me this is no longer the case. I disagree with that. It maybe is not as much the case as it used to be. But so many people, I feel like, who find their way to a kitchen had the relationship to school that you just described.
And the words you just described, it, they did not like sitting still. That was a big problem for a lot of cooks. They were just bored. Forget the sitting still part. They were bored. They like being on their feet. They like doing things with their hands. I've also felt, and I've had people say this to me, that that was more true of men who go to a kitchen than women, generally speaking. But you're talking in exactly the terms that I think about as a natural pathway to the kitchen.
Yeah, I definitely think it's pretty much everyone I know or my friends have had the same experience.
They have.
As I've had
growing
up. And I can definitely see women be maybe a little bit more relaxed and not that far off. But yeah, it's just everything was just so hard.
It was hard for you.
Yeah. I had to sit on my hands in school.
Literally?
Yeah.
You taught yourself that or someone told you
told
to do
me.
That?
The teacher told me to sit on my hands.
Okay, so that's an embarrassing thing for a child to be told. I assume you were told it publicly.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so that's embarrassing. It doesn't feel good to fail it. I don't mean literally get an F, but to not do well at something. That feels bad, right?
Yes, definitely.
Did it make you insecure? Was it hard for you emotionally to be, forget the boredom. Did it take a toll on you, on your like psyche, to be in a situation that just felt wrong to you?
It definitely did. And I was always not an overachiever, but I always wanted to be the best, and I always wanted to succeed, and I tried so hard to be able to understand what I was doing, but it just never worked.
Yeah,
and it's just something
tough.
That.
How was your family around that? Did they?
I mean, they were supportive, and they understood that going to another meeting in school, talking to the teachers about my progress was just part of it. They let me do a lot of activities outside of school.
Yeah.
Like I was very involved with my horses and riding and
you
things
were
like that.
Competitively
so.
Or?
Yes.
How did that work? Like what did you, like how so? Racing or I don't even know the terms.
No, I did both dressage and, and horseback jumping.
You
did? Mostly there was dressage actually.
Uh-huh.
But that was my mornings and my afternoons, my nights, weekends. Every time I had was what's for that.
Yeah. What feeling did that give you?
It was kind of similar to actually nowadays with the cooking, because that's what's also something that I felt that I was good at, that I could do, and I didn't have to concentrate that hard. It's just also something that came naturally.
Fair. That's interesting. You also, can I say that? You've mentioned this enough. You dance, or you used to.
Yes, I do.
You still do, do we call it, Latin dance?
Latin dance.
Yeah. You still do that?
Oh, yes.
Is that similar as well?
Yes, for sure. Anything that involves, I guess, maybe movement and be able to use the different side. What do they say? The left side of the brain?
Yeah.
My right side haven't caught up, so.
Got it. Okay. So when do you decide that you're going to start pursuing or might be interested in pursuing cooking as a profession?
I'm very young. I'm not exactly sure when, but it was around being early teenage.
That young?
Yeah.
And was it, before we go any further, I'm sorry, I should say this. We are here at Aquavine, and people can I probably will have said this in the interview, but can you tell us a little about where you grew up?
I grew up on the west coast of Sweden, in a very, very small town where I would, my mom would tell me in the summers I would actually go out on in the middle of the street and lie down and sunbathe on the concrete because it was so warm. Like, that's how small it was.
In the middle of the street?
In the middle
of the
street.
I mean, there was no concern that a car would come by.
They would just stop, go in, and tell my mom she's out on the street again, and they would move me.
Oh, my God.
So that's how small it was.
Okay.
And, growing up there was... it was on the west coast of Sweden, so we had a lot of seafood around and all of that. And every summer we would go up outside of Gothenburg, rent a cabin, go fishing and eat shellfish and things like that.
Yeah.
So that whole life in the beginning was very much revolved around food.
Yes.
Especially seafood.
Uh-huh.
And I think growing up that way was... I learned at an early age what I liked and what I didn't like.
In food.
And I think part of the way I came to realize that it was just easier sometimes to make the food yourself than...
To get what you wanted.
To get what I wanted, I kind of had to do it myself.
When you look back, do you feel like you had a good palate naturally? Like when you look back at what you liked as a kid, what you gravitated to, what you thought, oh, I'm going to do this myself. The thing you were doing yourself, when you think back, was it pretty good?
I think so. My friends and families around me would say I was extremely picky.
Uh-huh.
But I think that also came from knowing what I wanted to eat. And I'm still that way today where I see food as something else than just being nutritious. If there's nothing that I would enjoy eating, I probably would starve that day than eat something.
Really? So you don't just eat as a matter of function?
No.
Even at home?
No.
It's always not an event, but it's always a deliberate decision.
It has to be something I enjoy, otherwise I can't eat it.
Really? So you would never eat something like a protein bar?
Depends on what it is. I like the ones that has the nuts and the cranberries in them.
Okay.
But like the pure protein bar, no.
Right. So something that had actual food in it,
yeah,
you could deal with. What made you think about chefing even as a profession? Like, had you been to restaurants and had you met chefs? Had you seen them on television?
I didn't really know anything about chefs or how a restaurant was, or I never been in a restaurant. And even going to school, I didn't really know what a professional cook was. Yeah. All I had in my mind was watching my mom and my grandmother in the kitchen and how they cooked and the food that they produced.
Right.
So I was actually quite lost when I went to Stockholm and started restaurant school there.
Yeah.
It wasn't until my first semester where I started realizing about all these chefs and
the possibilities of the business
and what they were doing and things like that.
Was that really exciting when you started to see what was out there?
It was. And then the funny thing as well, I'm doing a dinner with Elizabeth Faulkner this coming week.
Oh yeah, I saw that. Yeah,
and I told her as well that she was one of the first ones that I spotted on TV
from back home. Wow.
So.
Yeah. So you saw her, doing her cakes or something?
I don't remember exactly what cooking show it was, but...
She made an impression
for sure. She's one of the first ones outside of Sweden as a country.
Interesting. And she, personality-wise, is sort of the polar opposite of you.
Yeah.
She's an unshy individual.
And I think maybe that's a little bit what draw me to
opposites
it as
attract.
Well. Opposite. Because it's always... it's always those personalities that I wish that I were or could be.
Really?
But I've always been very introverted.
So what do you... You go to cooking school. You start to have a sense of what you might want to do. And then when you start working, where do you go?
So my first internship in school was at a place called Edsbacka Krog.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that much, to be honest, actually, about the place when I got there. And it was this restaurant that was an hour outside of Stockholm.
Yeah.
So they weren't really, they would always say they were in a little bubble because it was still a fine dining restaurant, but it wasn't inside of Stockholm.
Right.
So they kept their own little family out there. And
okay.
I'm very happy that I ended up there as my first restaurant. And 6 months in, they got their second Michelin star.
Wow.
And that's when I think everything opened up in my head, like seeing every hard work go into it and how much that meant to the cooks and the chefs and everyone was there. I think that was the first experience I had where it's like, wow, this is more than just cooking. Up till then, nothing had really like...
Right.
When it comes to how good of a restaurant or awards and things like that, never registered in my head.
Right. What kind of food did they do there? Was it traditional? Was it sort of more personal?
It was very traditional Swedish cuisine meeting French.
Okay.
So they had the flavors and the ingredients were very classical Swedish.
Yes.
But the techniques
were in a French package. Right.
But I remember the way that the chef taught us to do dishes was always very inspiring because he would come up with an idea, but he would never finish it. And then he would give it to us and go, figure it out.
As a team.
And then we're changing the menu in 2 weeks.
Okay.
So And even then, as a new kid coming out of school, being told to like figure it out, you're like, figure what out? Like, I don't know how to do this. But it turned out to like wanting you to like, you worked harder and you really like, and it wasn't like a whole dishes. It was like elements here and there that he saw that he wanted, but he left it up to us to come up with a solution.
So he would leave one little, if it was a jigsaw puzzle, he would leave one corner maybe unfinished. So you all would come up with the last, like what herb or
how to do certain things. Like he, for example, he wanted a twill to be a certain way, but he had no idea how to do it.
Yeah.
So we had to build or figure out like how to construct it that way.
Uh-huh.
Things like that.
So that must have been great.
It was amazing.
Yeah. And then he would edit you guys. I assume he would edit you all. Like you would present and he would say, maybe go back and change this.
Exactly.
Or, yeah.
Like and sometimes nothing happened and sometimes it went on the menu perfectly.
And that made you feel great.
Yeah, that was amazing.
Uh-huh. That's awesome. Yeah. And you were what? How old were you at the time?
What was I, 17 and a half?
Wow. Something like that. That's very empowering.
And I think that's the way he ran his kitchen. I was there for almost 5 years and I was still one of the shortest period of time.
Uh-huh.
Most people stay for 7-10 years.
How big a team, roughly?
I would say it was around 15 mm-hmm. paid people in the kitchen and maybe 20 interns or something like that.
Okay. So, I guess if you have 2 Michelin stars, you can...
Yeah. And it was back then, it was the only 2 Michelin star in northern in the Nordic countries.
Yeah.
So a lot of people were coming in.
That was a competitive thing to get a stage in that kitchen. So you eventually settle in on pastry. When did you devote yourself to that part of cooking?
That actually happened the first day I stepped into that restaurant.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I really wanted to do savory, and I know I inspired to be like, I wanted to work with sauces and juice and things like that.
Yeah.
But I got there and there was this big guy who grabbed a hold of me and was just like, okay, you're my intern. And he turned out to be the pastry chef. And
you almost described that. It sounds like a prison movie or something.
But
that was it? You had no say in the matter?
No say.
Now privately, when that was said to you, were you like, what? Was that a complete curveball in your life?
It was.
And
I was very confused. But it's also pastries in Sweden, or we call them the cold section.
Yeah.
You do starters as well as desserts.
Okay.
So you end up on a line where you actually produce, like, you would do the foie gras terrine and the salmon, but everything...
It wasn't a completely different department the way we think of it here in the U.S.
No, but... When you look at, especially in that kitchen, when you looked at the starters, they were very pastry technique inspired.
Okay.
So it was some of the things were very hard for cooks to get around and sort out in their heads.
Because they were so precise?
Yeah, and the techniques and the way you had to do it.
Yeah.
It's just, pastry and savory is 2 different mindsets of cooks. And I guess that's why you gravitate towards one
or
the other.
Well, I said this to you once in another interview. I don't know if you'll remember it, but Wayne Harley Brockman, who was, I think he may still technically be the pastry chef at Porterhouse. I met him at a Christmas party maybe 20 years ago. And we were just talking. And he said to me what you just said, it was 2 different things. And I asked him to describe it. And he said, chefs are surgeons. Pastry chefs are pharmacists.
Sounds about right.
And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, chefs, it's like triage. Like you just get in there and you're troubleshooting and it's, you know, you're turning out the food and there's a lot of pressure. And he said, in pastry chefs, it's formulas and weights and measurements. And it's, you can't be like that.
You have to plan a week in advance.
And it's very precise. A lot of what you're doing is very precise. You can't just improvise.
No, if you miss a step in the beginning, you're screwed.
You go back. So a number of people have said to me, even people who really they're kind of known their whole career for the savory side, but maybe worked earlier in their career in pastry, have said to me that is invaluable experience. Because even if you end up on the other side, because of exactly what you were just saying, that you do learn
precision. You do learn discipline, that it's a really good thing to put yourself through. Do you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. And I encourage all my cooks here, if any one of them ever wants to take a swing at pastry or move into pastry for a short time, they're all welcome to do it if a spot opens up. So I do have one of my my savory cooks who's been with me for a long time move into pastry a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
So, and he's learning. It's a bit of a struggle, but he's getting there.
Right. So do you, tell me how you end up here. How do you end up in the United States? How do you end up in New York City?
I remember we had a really long service back at my old job in Sweden, and everyone went out to a pub afterwards and had some beers, and we were all joking about, I was talking the whole night about wanting to move to New York and things like that. And then I went home, I woke up the next morning, and I had this Facebook message from Marcus Jernmark, the head chef here, asking, he was looking for a pastry chef, asking if I wanted that position.
Yeah.
And it was a Saturday or something like that. So I thought one of the guys from work was like playing me a prank.
Really?
So, because I was talking so much about it.
About what, New York?
About New York.
Because
going
why?
To New York. Because it's always been in my dream to come here. So I thought for some reason they would just, I don't know.
That would be sort of mean. Am I misremembering this? Had you not come through here? I feel like you told me this once, that you had come through here on your way to or from maybe Mexico?
Yes. I went on, our vacation is a little bit different back home. So I went to Mexico for 4 weeks.
Would the restaurant close for a period of time?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, they close down
summer?
Every summer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I went to Mexico and I had a connecting flight in New York back to Sweden. And for some reason, I just got this feeling that I was done with Mexico at that time. So I redid it a little, and I got to stay 3 days. I changed my flight, so I got to stay 3 days in New York. And I had no idea. I never read up on anything when I travel.
Right. You don't? You like to just be thrown into it?
Yes. And I know now that the place I stayed at, the hostel, was at Astor Place.
Okay.
Which I didn't know at the time.
Okay.
And
what year is this roughly? Oh, early 2000s?
Maybe 2005, something like that.
Okay.
2004.
Okay. So that's pretty much Astor Place the way it looks today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I just remember out walking. I came coming across Union Square.
Yeah.
All the people that were outside and like throwing little glowing things in the air and
right.
dancing. And then last night I actually accidentally stumbled across Times Square.
Uh-huh.
How you actually do that, I don't know. But
right.
I totally forgot that.
So you were just exploring the city and you were alone?
I was alone.
Did you spoke English at this point?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So you could get around. You could ask questions. And you found the city, I guess you didn't find it intimidating.
No, I found it more, what do you call it, intoxicated?
Intoxicating?
Intoxicating.
You did. Look, you like lit up when you said
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it was. It's
you took to it right away.
So different.
Did everything that surprise you? Because I feel like a lot of people, I mean, this was a little bit after, the city was really in decline in like the 70s and the early 80s when I moved here. But I do feel like I've talked to people who come here from overseas, and people, like, their family thought they were crazy. They told them to be careful, you know, don't get mugged. Had you heard things like that about New York, or not so much at that point in time?
No, I've had, and pretty much everywhere I go, I think New York has been one of the safest places that I've traveled to.
Yeah.
For the years before that, I've put myself in the worst countries where you're not supposed to be.
Okay. But you didn't find New York. Like, did you find it friendly?
I did. Very friendly.
See, when I came here as a student, I came here as a college student at 17, and I never experienced that New York you see in movies, you know, like people, get out of my way, you know. I mean, you do, of course, a little bit. But I find New York, I've always loved New Yorkers. Yeah. They've always, directions, help, friends. I mean, I have friends going back to the first year I moved here, which was a long time ago now. Yeah. That was your experience of the city.
Yeah, no, I loved it. And after that, I was just like, this is where one day I'm going to work.
Did you explore the food here at all when you visited?
Not in the way of find any restaurants, no.
Right.
I didn't.
Yeah. Was that a budgetary thing at that
yes,
age? Yeah, you couldn't.
Was.
Yeah.
And I've come 4 weeks from Mexico, so I've pretty much blown my
right. So you weren't going to go. You weren't going to have dinner at Jean George or right.
No, okay. I wish I could, but
so you go home and then you get this message from Marcus. It's you think it's a prank.
I didn't even answer straight away until 2 days later. I got back to work and tried to talk to everyone and see what was going on. And it turned out it was actually real.
Yeah.
So after that, everything moved really fast. He asked me if I wanted a position. We were talking on the phone like maybe once or twice.
Yeah.
And then he was like, okay, done deal. Can you be here next month? I was like, what? No. Like it takes time to get a visa. But I managed... I got it done, and yeah.
So you never cooked for them?
No.
How does that work? Did that surprise you?
I don't know. All my life, I've never really... I never applied for a job. I guess
you never did an audition meal. Or
lucky that way. I've always been offered positions, so I wasn't really that surprised. And also, when it comes down to pastry chefs and in Sweden, there's not that many.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, we don't have that culture where you have a pastry department in restaurants.
Right. Yeah.
You do. Normally, it's the chef
who
thinks about the desserts, and then the line cooks, whoever
execute.
Works at Garmandier does it. So there's not a lot of people to choose from as well.
Yeah.
And it was supposed to be for 1 year. So.
Oh, really? Why?
That's the visa that we come over.
Oh, okay.
So we get a J-1, which 1 year.
Okay. So you come over, you take the job, and what was it like getting... You'd been here for an exciting visit. What was it like when you move here, when you have to find an apartment that you can afford, and then when you start cooking under the microscope of a New York City kitchen with everything that comes with? What was your indoctrination actually moving here like?
Again, I think I've been really lucky in a lot of things happening in my life.
Uh-huh.
I came over at the same time as another Swedish girl who's actually going to be my pastry cook for a year as well. She had an aunt living in New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
So they took us in for the first week while we found a place to live at. But it's so strange because... I remember the apartments here in New York, the standard is not the same as you would see in Sweden.
You mean what you could afford as a young person in New York City?
And I we had a two-bedroom. It was $2,500 a month.
What were you in?
We were in 66th Street.
You were in Manhattan for that?
Yeah.
Really? Was it rent stabilized?
It was, we signed a lease for a year.
Okay. Okay.
It worked out.
Non-New Yorkers, this will sound crazy, but that's a really good deal.
For us, it was a lot of money.
Yeah, right.
And
but you're talking, when you say the standard isn't the same, anybody who's come to New York as a young person and gone through the real estate listings, and then you go and look at apartments, and you see things that anywhere else would be insane.
Yeah, and I remember looking at the apartment, and we spend pretty much 2 weeks, deep cleaning.
I'm sure.
Because it was so nasty.
Yeah. Did you have mice?
Not that I saw at that time, but we did have later in the winter because this was high
That's
summer.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
But I was just like, this is crazy. No one would live like this.
Yes. Yeah. But it was worth it to you to be here.
It was. Yeah. And I was never home. I mean,
I
my first 6 months, I lived here.
Yeah.
I was here.
You just go
8
home and fall asleep.
And I would go home at midnight. And
right.
And it was just...
So how did you find being in a kitchen like in New York City at a restaurant at this caliber? What was that like for you?
It was... I think it was mostly a little bit weird and strange because the structure is so different here.
Mm.
I'm used to, I was, back then, I tried to mold this restaurant a little bit more towards the way I want it. But back then, it was, you were hired to do something.
Yes.
And you didn't do anything else.
Yes.
And that was very frustrating for me because I'm used to everyone having sort of a communal role.
Right.
And even if you didn't, everyone would still do everything in a restaurant back
so
home.
So if I put it in athletic terms, everybody was cross-trained.
Yes.
Everybody could do everything.
Pretty much.
More or less.
And if you worked front of the house, you helped out behind the bar, you
right.
would do the dishes,
right.
or like the cooks would go in, and if the porter didn't show up, we would do the dishes and things like that. And that was something that was so strange to me coming here that, no, I just serve bread. I was like, what do you mean you don't just serve bread? Can you take the plate out? No, I don't carry plates. I was like, what?
Yeah.
Like, what is this? Like, but over the years I've been here, they're all been very supportive nowadays.
Uh-huh. That was what you're describing, though. That was literal, the way people talked about their individual positions.
Yeah, and it's like that in many, most places in New York City or in U.S., because that's how it works.
Right, but don't you find, I mean, I don't know, I don't work in, I've never worked in a kitchen since, I mean, not really. When I was a kid, I worked in a restaurant, but I assume there must be some people who aren't like that. People who are just hungry for experience, advancement. No?
No, there is. There definitely is. And
then,
and that was something that it taken me years to do, but 8 years later, everyone that's here with me today knows how I like it.
Yes.
And they all are very supportive and they all help out and, it doesn't matter if you're an assistant or a captain. Everyone helps each other. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a penny bright, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel, Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
This episode is brought to you by Brooklyn Botanic Garden, a stunning 52-acre garden in the heart of Brooklyn, featuring spectacular plant displays year-round. On Thursday, August 23rd, Brooklyn Botanic Garden will host the Beer and Bocce Benefit, a one-of-a-kind garden party featuring lawn games, live music, and unlimited beer tastings by some of Brooklyn's top beer makers. Proceeds from the Beer and Bocce Benefit provide essential support for the garden's educational and community programs. And mark your calendars for the annual Chili Pepper Festival on Saturday, September 29th. New York's hottest fall tradition will set the garden ablaze with scorching bands from around the world, dozens of fiery food artisans, and hours of chili chocolate debauchery. Learn more about Brooklyn Botanic Garden at bbg.org.
Welcome back. We'll get you right to the rest of our interview with Chef Emma Benson at Aquavit Restaurant. But first, Caitlin, I'm not going to read them this week because of my identity crisis, but there were some lovely reviews on iTunes.
Ah.
One person wrote in and said that her daughter had seen me speak at the Culinary Institute of America back in April, told her to read the book. So the mom is now reading the book, my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, about the chefs of the 70s and 80s. It's the weekly plug. And has gone and checked out my blog and said that the show has given her a sense of the life that her daughter is embarking on.
This is a really good mom.
That is a good mom.
And I mean, that
comment.
Is really, awesome comment, great parent.
Yeah, that made me, that's the first of its kind for us. And other chefs who are listening, you know, during prep time and all this stuff that I just love to hear. So to those of you who did write in, because of my identity crisis, I am keeping it a little short this week and not reading them. But I just want y'all to know I do appreciate it. If you would like to leave a review for us, you can do that on iTunes or Stitcher. Or you can just go to iTunes and Stitcher and leave a rating, much as you do for, say, an Uber driver, 1 to 5 stars. And the best way to keep up with the show is to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher.
You can also follow the show. I suggest you do that on Instagram. You can also do it on Facebook. The handle is at Chef Podcast on Instagram. Every time we do drop an episode, I put the link in the bio, put a picture up, and that is a good way to know when there's a new show up. And you can, if you haven't subscribed to the show, you can follow the link. Although subscribing is by far the easiest way to do it. The show just pops up in your queue, mm-hmm. and you can listen to it wherever you do that. Easy. Is there anything else we need to talk about?
I think that's it.
Okay. So with that, I'm going to return you to the rest of my interview with Chef Emma Benson, recorded last week at Aquavit Restaurant in New York City. Hope you enjoy the rest of it. You come here from your home country. You're cooking food in the Swedish category, right? A fancy New York City restaurant. And also for predominantly an American audience all of a mm-hmm. sudden. How did you adjust what you did, if at all, for your new diners?
When it comes to desserts,
yeah.
I definitely had to bump up the sweetness.
You had to. This is how people look at Americans. The sugar quotient went up.
Yeah, everything I produce in my first desserts was just like, oh, it's too sour. It's like, it wasn't well received. So yeah. I started bumping up the sweetness in it a little bit, and
beyond your own palate dictated.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's so funny.
That was for desserts, and then when it comes to savory, I do have to pull down the salt and the.
You had to lower the salt.
Lower the salt.
Okay.
So that's something that Europeans, especially Nordic countries, because the culture, the food culture we have, we used to a lot of salt.
Because of the history of like preservation and all that kind of curing. And that's one of the main foundations, right?
So. So that's one of the things on the savory side that we have to pull down.
Yeah.
I know, and every time my parents come over, my mom, wherever she goes, she have a little salt.
She carries her own?
She carries around a little thing of salt in her purse. So everywhere they go, she's like...
Nothing has enough salt on it.
No, nothing.
Oh my gosh.
And I used to be like that in the beginning too, but slowly, the longer I've been here, the salt in me goes down a little.
But in terms of what you were serving, did you have to kind of get a little more complex? Did your presentations become more intricate? Did the recipes become more complex, or were you doing very similar things to what you were doing back home?
No, I struggled a lot in the beginning.
Yeah.
I was doing a lot of desserts and showing dishes that weren't approved, that had to be worked on.
So you would put stuff in front of Marcus,
mm-hmm.
and you would get feedback and be sent to...
To redo it?
Oof.
And looking back at it, I mean, there were moments where I was like so angry and in tears, and I was like, I can't believe like this is perfect. But then I worked on it some more, and I was like, oh God, I'm such an idiot. Of course, it wasn't perfect.
Right. Like,
and then that was, I think, the first time I've actually led myself to realize that. Nothing is ever perfect.
Okay, like, that's so funny. That was the question I was about to ask you. Because when you just said perfect, I thought, well, do you believe? Because that's the thing with a lot of people. A lot of creative people believe you'll never get to perfection in whatever you do.
Yeah. But that was something when I started, like, this is perfect. And I was like, no, Emma, you're just being lazy. This is not perfect. Nothing is perfect.
Well, lazy is harsh. You didn't know yet.
Yeah.
No? Okay. No, really. Wrong? Am I wrong? I think you're just being young.
Yeah, maybe. That's true. Looking back at it now,
proud.
I'm like,
yeah.
I felt like I was lazy.
Yeah.
Or settling for not being all the way there.
Yeah. So after how many years does Mark, that you're here, does he leave?
I came at 2010 and he left 14.
Okay. And then this unbelievable thing happens. Tell us what happens.
Yeah, all of a sudden one day we were out of a head chef.
Uh-huh.
And Håkan, our owner, asked me if I was interested in taking the position. And it was, I'm not very good at believing in myself from the beginning. So being asked that question, I was like, this is just crazy.
It's,
like,
you had no idea this was coming.
No.
Yeah.
And I didn't even like cross my mind that it would ever be me. So
this wasn't a big sit down. He just casually mentioned this to you one day.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that was a good thing. If it was a sit down, I would probably have freaked out completely.
Right. So what was your initial response?
I said, I'll help until he finds someone else.
Yeah.
And
inside you're what? Terrified.
Oh, I'm freaking out. I mean, I have no idea. I'm also in a whole different city. Like, where do I get fish from? I don't know. Like,
you'd never had to deal with that part of the job.
There was so much stuff, and it just it. I don't think I slept for another 6 months again. It's just like it was so much to figure out.
So initially, was it a temporary thing? At least as far as you knew.
As far as I knew, yeah. Okay.
But when you look back, what he was playing you?
part of me feel like he wasn't very looking very hard, to be honest.
Okay, but this was an amazing. He had an amazing confidence in you. No?
Yeah, no, he did, and I'm so grateful that he did. It's extraordinary when there's people around who see something that you don't yourself.
When you have you ever talked to him about it? Like why he, what he saw, or what made him think that wasn't the history of this restaurant? Oh. It wasn't like that was something he'd done before. It's not that normal. Or it's not that usual. And, you know, there have also been these people like Alex Stupak, who was one of the best pastry chefs in the country. When he decided to switch gears and go and do what he did at Empeyon, people thought he was crazy. Now, he got the last laugh. But that seemed like a big deal. This wasn't even your... This was an owner seeing in his pastry chef something that you didn't see in yourself.
Yeah.
Did he ever tell you what it was?
He said he really liked the way I ran my pastry department here.
Interesting.
And how I accelerated it from what it was during those 4 years when I started to where it was that day. That's what he said. Made him believe that I could do it.
Okay. So. Now, if you don't mind me describing this, and this is an audio recording, I've mentioned a few times where you like lit up. You almost have tears in your eyes as you remember this moment, if you don't mind me saying that.
No, it's fine.
I mean, you're not like falling apart, but this was clearly very meaningful to you.
It was.
Yeah. Okay.
Sure.
So how do you go about, first of all, how big was that pastry department that he admired? How many people? You plus how many?
Three more.
Okay.
3 to 4, depending on the season.
And the savory side of the kitchen here, how many people are we talking, roughly?
12 to 15.
12. Okay. So 4 times.
Yeah.
Okay, at least. How do you even go about getting your head around the food, and then second of all, your head around this unprecedented, the management part of the job?
It was hard, but I had my head chef who's with me today, was just starting out as well, 1 year in here. Uh-huh. So he was with me, and I had another sous chef who supported me and helped me a lot along the way.
Yeah.
And it was nothing that was rushed. Everything was very like calm and organized in a way.
Yeah.
But we took it step by step. Everyone helped each other and I've learned so much from them over the years as well. There's things that not just the management position or ordering and dealing with all that, but we also go down to butchering, to cooking techniques, like things that were so outdated in my head from school 15 years ago that I had to relearn again.
Yes.
So I think throughout the years now, it's actually quite amazing because I'm still, every day I walk in here, I learn something new. So it's...
From your team?
From my team.
Okay, this is...
really cool.
This is a way I'm not used to hearing chefs speak. What do you attribute this to? Necessity? The sort of point of view you had from your job back home where everybody was sort of
cross-trained and, you know, people stayed for years and it was like, basically you describe it almost like a family situation. Yeah. Where do you think this openness that you have to that relationship with your team comes from? It seems very, it doesn't seem that common to me, but it seems very evolved to me. It seems very practical and very smart.
And it wasn't always. I know in the beginning I tried to, especially with all the pressure on me, that I wanted to know everything and I wanted to teach people. And then I think one day I came to the understanding that I don't. And I don't want to be that person who just fakes it till they make it. Like, I want to be open about if I don't know how to do something.
Yeah.
I want to learn. So, I don't want to stay away from it.
Right. So. Am I correct in assuming that despite your own hesitancy when you were offered that the position, right? That if I'm understanding what you're saying, once you accepted it, there was a need for you to be the leader or come across as the leader. That's what you're saying. So you didn't want to seem like you wanted to be the person in the kitchen who knew the most, who was the most confident, right?
Yes.
That's what you're saying. But at some point, you realize in some aspects you weren't, and you. The thing about faking it to me, especially in a kitchen where food's coming out periodically, right? I mean, there's a test every night, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to fool anybody, it seems to me. Like if you are faking it, your team's going to be talking behind your back. They're going to be looking for new jobs. They're going to be right. I mean, that's especially in this era where there's so much competition for good people. So how did your team respond when you did that? Were they there for you?
They were. And I mean, even today, I encourage everyone in the team to learn and new techniques. And there's so much stuff coming up every day that if anyone ever wants to... I remember in the beginning, we were doing a lot of fermentation and all of those things that none of us have really done before.
Right.
So we started actually studying it and reading up on it.
Yeah.
And my head chef got really involved in everything about it and super interested. So we all kind of like piggybacked and like learned together about all these new things that we've never done before.
That's exciting.
And I think that's like one of the most fun things with work
that
when you get to the top and you get to lead a kitchen, you don't really get to learn anymore.
Right.
And I feel like that's a shame because there's so much you can learn from your team. Everyone has their own specialities and whatever they do. And I started realizing that I do have 15 years of pastry in my background. So that is what I bring to the table.
Yeah.
Like all of those techniques and the way to see colors and contrast and how to plate and things like that. That's what I bring to the table. I might not be the best butcher, but I don't have to be the best on everything.
Right.
I just have to be the best at orchestra and put it together.
Right.
And then you learn to utilize what I have in front of me.
Uh-huh.
And because it's not a one-man show. You have to have a kitchen team to back you up.
Yeah.
So for me to try and be the best at everything, it took so much energy out of me that I lost that other part.
There's so much influence out there. There's so many, I mean, a little less in this restaurant because of the type of food you do, but there's so much going on in food today that you might have a cook who's really know, like fermentation, who really knows a lot about that or really knows a lot about whatever or, you know, knows a lot about a certain country's food or, and it'd be silly not to take advantage of that
or to
learn from that. I think the rules have changed a little bit. You're describing what seems to me like a very special situation, like a little world of its own back there in the kitchen.
No,
does it feel like that?
It does. It does for sure. And I tend to feel that the way I build my team back there is I do take in a lot of young individuals or just coming out of schools.
You do.
And I try and mix and match a little bit with my chefs that I have that are a little bit more seasoned as well. But I feel like that's where a part of it has to start, because their minds are just like new and they're thinking in a way where like sometimes you have to pull the brakes and go like, no, 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 no.
Right.
You can't do that.
Right. Not everything is open to discussion.
But then there's stuff where you're like, I didn't know that.
Right.
Like, wow, they like you learned that, and like, I didn't know that you could do that.
Yeah.
And I was up at CIA the other week.
Did you give a commencement address?
I did.
Yeah, I saw that on your Instagram. How was that for you?
That was super scary.
How many sleepless nights before that?
I don't know. Maybe a couple. But
how long a talk? They're not that long.
I think I lasted 10 minutes.
Okay. Yeah,
so I did pretty well.
Okay.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
But it was just like having all these kids staring at you from the front rows.
Looking for the answers to everything in their life.
Yeah. And all I wanted to go like, oh my God, you're so screwed. It's so much hard work.
Was there a theme to the talk?
No, not really.
Okay.
I talked a little bit about my struggles growing up and what school meant to me and what the actually being a chef meant to me and a little bit about as well the struggles they're going to come across in life and how mentorship and friends are very important.
Yeah. Was there a one thing in that talk that you think was the most unique to you, like the thing that you only tend to hear yourself say to young people or that you feel is uniquely your advice?
I'm not sure if it's uniquely my advice, but I always tell young people that they have to start value themselves when they go out in the industry, that if there's a kitchen where you don't feel appreciated or that you're learning or being treated in a certain way, then move on, because there's so many kitchens out there and there's so many chefs that actually wants you to work for you.
Right.
So
that's interesting to me.
There's the days where when I was growing up, I never ended up in any of those kitchens, but the attitude was very different.
Yeah.
But I mean, I've had my fair share of cryings and the walk-ins.
Uh-huh.
But there comes a moment where you have to think to yourself, is it worth it?
Right.
The knowledge and on my resume that I've been here, is it worth it?
So here's
what, should I go somewhere else?
Can we talk about this for 2 seconds? I'm not questioning what you just said. I want to be clear about that. But this is so interesting to me because there are, as I'm sure you know, you go back to like the hard ass, right? Kitchen. You're smiling when I say that. I actually ghostwrote years ago I'm talking a long time ago, maybe 20 years, for a friend of mine was giving a commencement talk at the CIA. And his whole thing was, no kitchen is perfect. Don't be a whiner. Don't complain. Any job you take, you should stay for a year. I don't care.
Part of me agreed to it, but...
And I'm not challenging you, but what you're saying is the exact opposite of that.
There's a level to it.
Mm-hmm. In other words, don't be a spoiled brat.
Or a crybaby.
A crybaby. Don't be afraid to work hard.
But there are situations where you have to put yourself first as well. But
don't let yourself be disrespected.
Exactly.
Right. Right.
But of course, I mean, if you're in a kitchen and you get yelled at for doing something wrong, that's not... okay, I have to move on.
Right.
That's just, you did something wrong.
Right. It's stressful. If that happens every 10 minutes, that's another story.
And that's like I said, I've spent my fair share of crying in walk-ins and dry storage.
Yeah.
But I never felt that I was mistreated.
Right.
Because it was my fault.
Right.
I did it. So
right.
Like,
sure. Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I think... when you're very young, like people who are right out of school, right? You have maybe you're in a bad employment situation. This happened to me when I was in the film business. You think that if you quit, right, it seems like the biggest decision of all time. It seems like you're making an enemy for life. It seems like something that's gonna ruin your career, especially if you work for somebody who's well known, right? But that's rarely true.
But I do believe you. If you put yourself into something, you should definitely give it a year.
Yeah.
Because you are taking time from them to teach you.
Yes.
And they are, whoever employing you, are putting in work to
yes.
teach you.
Yes.
So I feel like it's very disrespectful after 2-3 months to leave.
To take what they had to offer and then market it.
And mark out. But it's yeah. It's one of those things, if you start somewhere and you feel like you don't belong,
yeah.
then leave after a week.
Do you tend to hold this? Everyone's talking about in the big cities in this country, right? In New York, San Francisco, Chicago, L.A., how hard it is to hold on to cooks today. Do you tend to hold on to people longer than the average kitchen, do you think?
Oh, I don't even know what the average kitchen do, but...
I mean, people tell me they lose a lot of cooks now in like 8 months. They don't even expect them there for that year we just talked about.
You kind of get that feeling a little bit straight away when they start, if they're going to last or not. And I also do have, I have a couple of kids who I know are on a 1-year visa as well.
Oh, okay.
So I know they're going to be here yeah. for a year with me. But you kind of get that feeling a little bit straight away.
Mm-hmm.
So you know a little bit who to invest in. And I also sit down and talk to them from time to time to
okay.
feel, just get a feel of how they're doing,
yeah.
what they feel, what they want to do.
Yeah.
I also try and switch their positions around
yeah.
Now and then so they don't get bored.
Yeah.
And keep them like occupied doing things.
Yeah.
But most of the ones I've had stay at least for a year, if not okay. a little bit longer.
Do you have any people back there who were there when you took over the kitchen?
One.
Okay.
My head chef is still with me.
Oh, that's great. And, that's nice.
My two sous chefs have been with me for almost as long. Actually, that's not... One of the sous chefs was a student when I took over.
That's great. So, yeah, I think you're doing... Yeah, it's well above the average. Do you at all strive to have sort of the... I mean, you can't have it exactly here in a city like New York, but that kitchen you talked about early on, where everybody sort of helps, where it's a learning experience. It sounds like that, maybe not... in a literal way, but it seems like that's the spirit of that kitchen very much kind of infuses what you do or how you is that accurate?
It is. And that's the way I run my kitchen as
yeah.
well. Everyone helps each other. There's no backstabbing, or if someone is done early, they
yeah.
help the other stations
right.
out. And it's very encouraging to see, even when if pastry,
yeah.
when I've lost pastry cooks
yeah.
and they're struggling, I have half the kitchen volunteering to go into pastry.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, okay, who wants to work extra? And
yeah.
they're like, me, I want. I was like, sure.
What about yourself? And do you how do you spend your days these days? Like, is there stuff that you still do during the prep day? Do you, I mean...
I butcher.
You butcher.
I like butchering. So I do that. Maybe not every day, but
uh-huh.
When I do have times in the mornings,
yeah.
I do that.
What do you like about it? Do you know?
I feel like it's one of those moments where I get to be a cook again, or like use my knife and
uh-huh.
and do things.
Yeah.
Because I'm not on the line.
Right.
I'm in the kitchen every day. I run
yeah.
the service and I
yeah.
plate and
yeah.
I do all of that. But I don't really never get the feeling of like...
That tactile...
The rush
yeah.
and like having to do stuff. Sometimes I step into Garmandier when they have me, but they mostly push me away.
Uh-huh.
I'm not allowed to cook.
But butchering is like that's your personal...
Yeah.
This is something I've talked to with a few guests this season. I think what chefs choose to do themselves in the way of prep or whatever is very telling. I think it's very interesting because you could do whatever you wanted if you wanted to, but you choose that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does it take you back to a certain job or a certain point in your career?
Not really. I think that was one of the first things that when taking over that I had to learn again. So I feel like that's one of the things where I like... It came on me so late in my
yeah.
career that
yeah.
it's like... I still like to evolve my techniques
yes.
in it. So the more I do it, the better I get at it.
Uh-huh. Well, it was great talking to you.
Same.
Thanks.
Let's go. Okay. It wasn't that hard. I can do this.
Okay. Thanks for doing it. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And that's our show for this week. Thank you to Chef Emma Benson for doing an interview. Caitlin, don't you think Emma is... She's a good interview.
Great interview.
I told her after the interview, I think
she... I don't think she came across as shy.
A little bit. Hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think as shy as she thinks she comes across as.
Maybe she's just slightly uncomfortable, but she's great.
Yeah. I really, really, really like her. And you need to go have her food. We got to do that.
Okay.
Anyway, thank you, Caitlin.
My pleasure.
Thank you, David Tatasciore, for splicing these things together every week. And to all of you out there in podcast land, thank you for listening to the show. I really appreciate it. And we'll see you back in a week, if not sooner, on Andrew Talks to Chefs.